I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a private equity firm focused on making investments in the cannabis industry. The company considers business opportunities as the legalization of marijuana continues throughout the United States. Some of Privateer's portfolio companies include Leafly, a user-generated reviews website for all things cannabis-related, Tilray, a producer of medical cannabis in British Columbia, Canada, and Marley Natural, a global brand in partnership with the Bob Marley family. The company is located in Seattle, Washington. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica, for having me.
I want to talk first about the history of marijuana. When was the first use of marijuana?
Oh, gosh. You know, there are reports of cannabis being used 5,000 years ago in China. So we know it's at least been used or consumed by humans for 5,000 years.
And where is it best grown?
I've been in this industry for about 5.5 years, and I've probably met the world's best cannabis grower about 1,000 times. You know, every place I go, every grower I meet claims to be the best grower.
And what is your opinion?
I think that there are different products grown well in different parts of the world. So certainly British Columbia has a well-known reputation for outdoor-grown natural cannabis at very high latitude. You can go to places like Jamaica or India or the Middle East, and cannabis is grown and consumed. It's an interesting product in that it is produced all around the world with very different flavors and properties, very similar to tea.
When was cannabis made illegal in the United States?
So it was right around the end of alcohol prohibition in the early to mid 1930s. Cannabis prohibition started.
How come?
Well, there's lots of different stories around that. Certain people say that it had something to do with William Randolph Hearst and the use of hemp as a newspaper material. He had a lot of investments in the forest products industry on the West Coast, printing or producing newspaper, as well as some of the petrochemical companies. DuPont is often mentioned. Many products that can be made with petrochemicals can also be made with hemp. And so there's a theory that those two colluded to create cannabis prohibition.
And is that your theory as well?
You know, I'm not really sure why it was prohibited. I do know that many of our investors are in this industry, interested in this industry for a financial return, but they're also looking for a social return measured by ending the harms caused by prohibition.
You mentioned your investors, and they really spread across the political spectrum, which is interesting to have those strange bedfellows.
One of the misconceptions about this industry is that it's a right-left issue, and it's not. So we have investors from the far right who see this as a states' rights issue, as a individual civil liberties issue. We have progressive liberals who see prohibition as a form of discrimination against African Americans and Hispanic Americans who are arrested at disproportionate rates for cannabis possession or distribution. In the 1970s, President Nixon declared his war on drugs. And you know, since then, I believe we've spent about $2 trillion fighting the war on drugs. And it's had a devastating effect. You know, it causes a lot of harm and at tremendous expense. So we incarcerate more people per capita in the United States than anywhere else in the world. You know, recent reports show roughly 800,000 Americans have been arrested, prosecuted, and are incarcerated for cannabis possession or distribution. Those are people who have lots of different rights taken away from them. They can't vote, they can't live in public housing, they can't get food stamps, they can't have their educational support through the Department of Education. And so it's devastated entire communities in the U.S. and has devastated communities specifically in the African American and Hispanic American communities.
What are the uses of cannabis that we might not even know outside of, let's say, the medical, the recreational ones? You smile. How come?
I do, because there are so many different uses for this product that when you start to talk about it, you sound a little bit crazy. So historically, cannabis and hemp were used for things like the sails that Christopher Columbus sailed to America with. Used for rope on sailing ships. The word canvas comes from cannabis. On the Canisoka wagons that were used for westward migration across the U.S., those had hemp fabric covers that you see. It was grown in Jamestown, the earliest colonies, as a vital crop. And grown by early presidents like Jefferson and Washington on their farms.
When we see hemp, like, is it all cannabis even now?
So it's all cannabis. It's all cannabis sativa. The main difference is really legal in the U.S. It's a legal distinction between cannabis sativa that has less than 0.3% THC. That's defined as hemp. Anything with more than 0.3% THC is defined as cannabis.
THC is tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the chemical that recreational users try to extract as they're smoking.
Yes, it's really the psychotropic ingredient in cannabis.
You mentioned the medical cannabis, and when you were considering starting Privateer, you and your co-founders, Michael Blue and Christian Groh, were researching the benefits of medical cannabis. Can you talk about what you discovered, what you found?
We entered this industry with a healthy dose of skepticism, and when we talk to medical patients, they use medical cannabis for a wide variety of reasons. So I've talked to patients who have cancer and are going through chemotherapy, oftentimes a second or third round of chemotherapy, and the drugs that they used on the first and second round didn't work, but they find efficacy in medical cannabis, typically used to suppress nausea and stimulate their appetite. I've talked to glaucoma patients who use medical cannabis to reduce ocular eye pressure. I've talked to patients who use it for Crohn's disease or multiple sclerosis. I've talked to patients who use it for pain, and veterans both in Canada and in the United States that use medical cannabis for the treatment of PTSD.
When you started to think about starting Privateer, you were working at Silicon Valley Bank in California. It was actually Silicon Valley Bank Analytics. What exactly were you doing for them?
So I was the COO of SVB Analytics, and our focus was on providing valuation services to venture capital firms and venture capital-backed startups.
And one of those startups was an inventory software company for marijuana dispensing. And can you talk about how you got connected?
Sure. So I like to say I knew a little bit about a lot of different companies, and I could typically place companies in 40 or 50 niches, and one day had a medical cannabis technology company from California come into our office. The bank didn't take them on as a client, but it got me thinking about this industry, or if there was an industry, and later that same week, I happened to be driving from San Francisco to Santa Clara. It's about a one-hour drive, and was listening to a radio show, actually an NPR radio show, talking about California Proposition 19. And I thought, well, this is two data points in a week. I need to look at this industry.
What was Proposition 19?
It was a full legalization for adult consumption initiative. That was on the California ballot.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a company focused on investing in opportunities related to legal cannabis for medical and recreational use. The company was the first in the cannabis industry to receive institutional capital, helping to legitimize this growing market. The three of you decide to leave your stable jobs, and there was kind of a defining moment when you went to a trade show where you were looking at, various people pitching their companies. Can you speak to why that was defining for you?
Well, the first 18 months, we were very quiet, and no one knew who we were or what we were doing. And so we would show up at these events in, wearing suits, in short haircuts. And you know, I think a lot of people thought we were with the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration. And so we would go to these events. The one you're mentioning was in San Francisco. And we sat towards the front of the room and we would listen to speaker after speaker. And they were on stage just saying these crazy things that no one would ever say in any other industry.
Like what?
Oh, you know, they were talking about taking your, this was 2010, 2011. They were talking about taking your cannabis company public and how to raise capital. And it was just, it was nuts. So we developed this technique where we would sit in the front of the room and anytime anyone said anything crazy, we would turn around and look throughout the room to see who had a frown on their face or who was rolling, you know, which people were rolling their eyes, because those were the people that we wanted to talk to because they were thinking about this similar to the way that we were thinking about this.
It was at that moment where you decided, well, instead of being a venture capital company, we'll be a private equity company. What did you see as the difference, or what was the shift in focus?
That was something that took place over 12 months. You know, we originally thought we were building a venture capital firm that would make passive investments into this industry. And that was our original thesis. And when we went around the world, when we went to various states, we realized that this industry was different. It was a massive opportunity, but there were no companies that were leaders. There were no standards. There were unprofessional companies, unprofessional, unsophisticated managers. The marketing and branding bar was extremely low. And it was a taboo industry. So at the time, we realized we couldn't be passive investors. We needed to be operators. We needed to take hands-on control. We needed to build teams. We needed to build relationships with external teams. You know, everything in this industry is harder. It's more difficult than anyone can possibly imagine. And so you know, we needed to recruit professional people. We needed to recruit professional vendors. You know, hiring a law firm or a marketing firm or a PR agency, you know, someone to do payroll or accounting or auditing, it's easier now, but it was harder back then. And things that, you know, would take literally a week in any other startup I've been involved with would take 3 to 4 months. You know, finding a bank, absolutely a miserable process.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer. We'll hear more from Brendan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a private equity firm focused on making investments in the cannabis industry. In the early days, you had a little motto, which was don't touch the leaf. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, so, you know, for us, we were uncertain about the regulatory environment in individual U.S. states and federally. We were concerned about the conflict between state and federal law. We were uncomfortable 5 years ago touching cannabis in the United States. It's one of the reasons why we jumped at the opportunity with Tilray in Canada, because we had the ability to operate with a federal license in a large country that didn't have any of the conflicts between federal and state law.
Right, and Tilray being a company that grows and processes and distributes medical marijuana in Canada and eventually perhaps globally. So then what is it that you wanted to invest in, if not the actual leaf, if not actual growers in the United States?
We were looking primarily at ancillary companies at the beginning. So software companies, web companies, app companies, companies that provided infrastructure. So lighting. Lighting for grow facilities, hydroponics, anything used to grow the plant. So, you know, from containers to packaging, you know, from really anything used to produce the product from seed to shelf is how we thought about the industry.
So these are like second derivative services that were helping to abet the growth of marijuana, but not touching, not actually investing in marijuana.
I'm not sure abet is the word that I would use,
but
yes, to help support, yes. Abet has a, yeah, is a little dangerous.
You mentioned the banks and how challenging it was to work with banks because they didn't want to be associated with cannabis. So how did you manage your cash?
So we've been fortunate in the United States, in individual states, and in other countries around the world, in that we've always had access to banking relationships. So that doesn't mean that we haven't had difficulties. Our first bank account was shut down, I think, after 3 months. Our second one, with a very large bank in the U.S., we operated there for about 16 months. And then a compliance officer in Cleveland, Ohio, saw me on TV one day, and we received a note, a letter, saying that we had 30 days to close our account, or they would mail us a cashier's check. I think at the time we had about $4 million in the bank. And so we scrambled to find another bank in the U.S. And our current bank, we've had for about 3 years now, and they've been fabulous.
You had an easier time with the banks to establish relationships where they are holding your cash, but most other cannabis companies don't have that luxury. How are they managing all this cash in a way that's above board?
I've been in a lot of uncomfortable situations in this industry. Probably the most discomforting environment is to be in a room with $1 million in cash, or be in a room with $2 million in cash. It's discomforting, it's smelly, and it doesn't feel like a secure environment. And unfortunately, that's how a lot of the larger, more legitimate operators in places like Washington and Colorado have to operate. For now, you know, they operate on cash. They pay payroll with cash. They pay their taxes with cash. They pay their rent or mortgages with cash. And it creates a lot of very, very unsafe transactions that put people in harm's way.
Now, did you benefit from your relationship with Silicon Valley Bank?
We did. That helped us to facilitate relationships with banks at the very beginning of this process. Mm-hmm. It didn't help on the venture capital side. When we first started in this industry, we went and met with a lot of individual partners at venture capital firms to let them know what we were doing. But we also started every meeting by saying, you know, you're never going to invest with us. You're never going to invest in our company. And that's a different type of venture capital meeting. It was much more interactive because they knew that we weren't expecting an investment from them at the time.
Why was that?
We had those meetings because we were concerned about reputational risk, and we had a lot of conversations with former colleagues, with our friends and family, letting them know why we were doing what we were doing and how we were thinking about this industry. No partner at a venture capital firm 5 years ago wanted to be known as the partner who made the first investment in the cannabis industry.
Now, what were some key moves that you made or that happened out in the legal realm that were helpful to you?
I think the biggest change that happened over the 5 years is that in November of 2012, Washington State and Colorado legalized recreational cannabis. A year later, both states opened up retail stores. That was a dramatic shift in the environment, that this was happening and the federal government wasn't stopping it. This is progressing at such a rapid stage that I think we're past the point of no return. I think the toothpaste is out of the tube, and no one can put it back in at this point.
You mentioned things that were happening outside the company. You had the wind at your back, but how about inside? You know, for example, a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration official named Patrick Moen came on board and became your chief of compliance. It's clear what those optics are, but can you speak to that further?
Sure. So Patrick Moen was a special agent in charge of a Drug Enforcement Administration field office in Oregon. And one day while he was driving, he heard an interview with me on the radio. And he had been thinking about cannabis prohibition and thinking about a career change. And so he connected with me on LinkedIn. His profile said he was with the Department of Justice. And so I met with him very nervously at a Starbucks in Portland, Oregon one day in the summer of 2013, and went in immediately could pick out the DEA agent, sat across from him with my coffee, and he slipped me his card. And he was with the DOJ, but he was really with the DEA. That was my first surprise. My second surprise was when he slipped me a white envelope. And I thought it might be something bad. My adrenaline kicked in, thinking that it was a subpoena or something like that. And it was his resume.
That measure, along with the institutional capital that came afterwards, further helped to meet your mission, which is just adding an institutional credibility to your pursuit.
That's right. And so, you know, for us, it was very difficult to raise our initial round of capital, $7 million. In March of 2015, we closed a round of $75 million, and it was a much easier round to close. The key milestone in that raise was that we announced we were the first institutional investor to make an investment into this industry.
That institutional investor was the venture capital fund, the Founders Fund, which is led by the PayPal founder, Peter Thiel. How did you meet Peter or his people?
It was a long process. In September of 2013, I was contacted by Jeff Lewis, one of the principals at Founders Fund. He had been looking at the industry and had come across Privateer Holdings, had come across me. He came into my office and I gave him our pitch. And that started a 16-month process where we would meet with individuals from Founders Fund in Seattle or San Francisco or New York or in British Columbia. And ultimately, it led to an investment by them in December of 2014.
What about the early capital raise when you were piecing together, it was a forced march in raising that initial $7 million.
It was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. I spoke at a private equity conference in Europe, and the organizers did a great job of not really telling people what industry it was from. So I got on stage and started by saying, I just closed the most difficult private equity round in the last 10 years. And about 10 minutes in, I mentioned the word cannabis for the first time. And so I'd sort of hooked them. And afterwards, a lot of people came up to me and said, I can't imagine raising any capital for cannabis companies. Yeah. And so it had its own challenges.
Like what? What's one anecdote, for example, that you can remember being grueling?
The biggest challenge is that none of our capital could come from an institutional investor in that round. So all of our capital, $7 million, came from essentially angel investors and single-family offices. And that just, it takes time. It took hundreds and hundreds of meetings to raise $7 million. I probably did that Series A pitch close to 500 times.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer, a company focused on investing in opportunities related to legal cannabis for medical and recreational use. We're talking about prohibition, and this prohibition kind of echoes, in a way, the repeal of prohibition with alcohol. And there's a story of President Kennedy's father, Joseph P. Kennedy, who was kind of in a similar moment to you, kind of seeing the repeal coming and positioning himself in a way that he would benefit. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So when we were looking at this industry, we tried to find other similar events in history that were similar to cannabis prohibition or the end of cannabis prohibition. And so we looked at the end of alcohol prohibition in the 1930s. And we looked at, there was a Canadian family, the Bronfman family, who generated significant wealth with Canadian brands towards the end of alcohol prohibition. And then Joseph P. Kennedy, who positioned himself well by securing European brands for sale in the United States as prohibition ended. And that seemed like the right model. It seemed like the right strategy. And so that's one of the reasons why we focus on brands in the cannabis industry.
Now, the brands that he secured the licenses to were like Gordon's Gin and Dewar's Whiskey, and he was importing. Somerset Importers that
yes.
his company?
The Bronfman family in Canada did something similar with Seagram's.
Sometimes comparisons are odious. Like, how is this not the repeal of alcohol prohibition?
I think one reason why the end of cannabis prohibition is different from the end of alcohol prohibition is that alcohol prohibition was relatively short. And so there was still a lot of infrastructure that was in place from pre-prohibition infrastructure. In this industry, it's really all being created from scratch. It's been well over 75 years, and there aren't robust models. There's not robust infrastructure for the end of cannabis prohibition. All of that needs to be created.
I want to talk about the image of cannabis, which you're trying to change by bringing, you know, like this corporate responsibility to the industry, to this kind of Wild West. You hired a branding company called Heckler Associates. What are some brands that they represent?
They represent New Balance tennis shoes. Probably they're best known for Starbucks, for naming Starbucks, and for designing the original Starbucks logo.
What do you want your association to be?
Our focus is on building companies, building professional teams, building brands that can fuel change. You know, what we learned as we looked at this industry is that this is a mainstream product consumed by mainstream people around the world. And every brand that we looked at 4 years ago, 5 years ago, really embraced the ubiquitous cliches around cannabis. And that was really dissimilar to the consumers that we saw.
So you had this New York Times ad that kind of helped to perpetuate this new image. Can you talk about that ad?
Sure. So it really started as an exercise. It started as an exercise as we were working on the Leafly brand. And we thought, okay, what does the first mainstream cannabis advertisement look like? You know, what would a page look like in the New York Times? And in July of 2014, a couple of different things happened. Governor Cuomo in New York signed the Compassionate Care Act into law, and that following week, the editorial board for the New York Times endorsed the end of cannabis prohibition or legalization of cannabis. And we took that old ad that we had created as an exercise off the shelf. We rapidly made changes and contacted the New York Times advertising section to see if they would let us place an ad in the New York Times. And they got back to us that same day. It was far less difficult than we imagined. And we placed the ad. And it was really covered around the world.
Well, what did the ad look like? What was the exercise?
Obviously, a New York cityscape, two people in front of a brownstone, one woman jogging, and a well-dressed gentleman coming out of his brownstone apartment. And it talks about the two strains of cannabis that they consume and why they consume them.
There was a New York Magazine article in the fall of 2015 talking about, you know, big cannabis. There are some public health concerns with the growing legalization of the industry, how the EPA or the Environmental Protection Agency and the FDA, they haven't caught up yet. And so people are using just these noxious chemicals in helping to grow the plant, like Avid and Floramite, for example. Can you speak to kind of how you're helping, if at all, to rein in that type of activity?
Sure. Every batch of medical cannabis that we produce in Canada is tested for mold, mildew, fungus, pesticides, heavy metals. It's tested for microbials like Salmonella and E. coli. You know, there's no other country in the world, no U.S. state that tests for all of those things. And every single batch that we sell has to be tested for those things. And so That's why we're interested in Canada, because it's very difficult to produce there under those regulations. And that process has educated us so that we can operate in other countries and around the world and help create standards, help create regulations that are safer for consumers, safer for patients. I think that's the way the whole industry is going. Mm-hmm. I would say that every product sold, you know, eventually every product sold will be safer than the Glad bag that someone can purchase on the streets of New York.
You live in Washington, where recreational cannabis is legal. Do you smoke marijuana?
So I grew up in San Francisco, and I went to Berkeley, and certainly was exposed to cannabis at an early age. You know, it was not something that I took a liking to. It's something that I consume occasionally. I'm more of a single beer person on a Friday night than cannabis.
You run triathlons, right?
I have run six Ironman triathlons. Yes.
Your wife is a ballet dancer with the Pacific Northwest Ballet, and you have one daughter.
One daughter, Eleanor.
What do your parents do?
I'm one of seven children. My mother stayed at home and raised us until I was a freshman in high school, and then she went back to school. She was a counselor. And my father taught high school science for 38 years.
What kind of child were you?
I was the sixth of seven children. We have a friend of the family who gave everyone different nicknames. I was the quiet Kennedy. We were talking about reputational risk earlier, and we were talking about having conversations with friends and family, and that was actually probably one of the more difficult things that we had to do, right? I had to have a conversation with my wife and say, I'm thinking about going into the cannabis industry. And I had to have that same conversation with my six brothers and sisters and with my parents who are older. They're in their 80s. They're far more, you know, despite being from San Francisco, they're far more Frank Sinatra than Grateful Dead. And that was a difficult conversation. And I had to have a conversation with my in-laws, my wife's parents, who are from Georgia. And so there's those little things that you don't think about that, you know, you certainly cause a lot of stress as you're anticipating those conversations.
So it probably helped being the quiet Kennedy, because inherent in that maybe is a responsible Kennedy.
Perhaps. You know, a lot of people were really worried that I was throwing it all away by jumping into this industry.
How do they feel now?
A lot of people that thought we were crazy 5 years ago, now they think we're a lot smarter than they did.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Brendan Kennedy, co-founder of Privateer. Coming up, we'll meet Skip Bennett, founder of Island Creek Oysters. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the oyster farmer, Skip Bennett. Skip is the founder of Island Creek Oysters, which grows oysters and supplies them to more than 400 chefs across the United States. Restaurants that serve his oysters include Thomas Keller's Per Se and French Laundry, the Eastern Standard in Boston, and the Catbird Seed in Nashville, Tennessee. Island Creek Oysters also operates its own restaurants called the Island Creek Oyster Bar and Row 34 in Boston, Massachusetts. Skip started Island Creek Oysters in Duxbury, Massachusetts in 1990. He sells roughly 120,000 oysters per week, or 5 million oysters per year. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
I would like to start with understanding how oysters grow.
Where we are, there's no wild oysters, so all of our oysters begin their life in a hatchery. We pick out oysters that have done really well in Duxbury Bay. We bring those in and we spawn them. They're sequential hermaphrodites, meaning that they're either male or female, but they switch back and forth. So we don't know until they release either eggs or sperm which one they are. And when they start to release, we isolate them and then just add a little bit of sperm and into the eggs, and they start to fertilize right before your eyes.
What do the oysters eat while they're growing?
So they only eat live phytoplankton.
Algae?
It is algae, yeah. In the hatchery, we grow six different species of plankton. As soon as we can get them big enough to get them out the door, and we also have to wait until the water's warm enough that there's plankton in the water and that they can survive, and then they're on their own.
How does their shell form? This is made of calcium carbonate.
They get it through the carbon in the water. The more that we can tumble them around, too, just bang them up a little bit in that summer, you can actually get the shell to grow more dense.
So, and what happens if you don't tumble them up a little bit?
They can grow long and thin shells, and really we want an oyster that's pretty compact. You know, maybe 2.5 to 3 inches would be, for me, the ideal oyster, with a really deep cup so that it has a lot of meat inside.
We talk about terroir, which is, you know, the land that wine might grow in. And similarly, you use a term miroir, which is kind of the environment that the oyster grows in.
It is. We select really round oysters, which are maybe a little non-traditional. Our oysters are very fluted. So we select for that. And then there's, you know, the type of plankton that grows in the water and the minerals that are there that play into the flavor profile.
How would you describe the taste of your oyster?
They change seasonally a little bit, but I always describe them as like super briny up front. And then there's kind of a real vegetal sweetness to them. And I think they finish very buttery.
What is the history of oysters in the United States? How long have people been eating oysters?
Well, I think, you know, probably it goes back to the first settlers, and clearly the Native Americans long before the settlers ate a lot of oysters. And we know that from the shell middens, the piles that were in the Chesapeake and in Maine, these massive piles of ancient shells. Over the years, 100 years ago, it was a big part of our culture. My dad, who grew up in the 40s, remembers having oyster stew every Wednesday night. And it was just because it was such a plentiful source of protein. In the 50s and the 60s, there were two diseases that wiped out kind of the largest populations of oysters in the United States. And that part of our culture was lost.
Why is there now this renaissance of oyster culture in the United States? Why are we seeing it on more menus now?
When I first started selling oysters in Boston, there was just a handful of restaurants that had oysters on the menu. And as we produced more and more, there were more and more restaurants that had it on the menu. And we used to think, wow, aren't we lucky? We kind of caught this while, you know, it's on the rise. But we realized that really what was going on was now that there was a local kind of dependable, high-quality source of oysters, that chefs were more willing to put them on the menu.
So it was going.
It was me and you know, a handful of other farmers at that time. And now there's a ton of oyster farmers on the East Coast. And it's been the rebirth of this oyster culture that's pretty interesting.
You talk about how you farm your oysters, but there's this kind of negative connotation attached to farming a bit. And I know you do it in a clean way, but talk to me about that for a moment.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that there is a negative connotation around it, because the crux of the issue is that there are 7 billion people on Earth now and not enough food to go around. You know, shellfish farming is probably one of the most sustainable ways to grow protein, because there's not a lot of inputs. So we're not growing grass to feed animals or growing grains to feed animals, and we're not using fertilizers or water. It's really what the oyster or the shellfish are eating to create the protein is something that's a nuisance to the water. It is, yeah. Well, the nitrogen causes excessive algal blooms. And when people live and work and farm or around the watershed, the nitrogen leaches into the water and you get excessive algal blooms, which shade out plant life and use up dissolved oxygen. So it really can make an inhospitable environment for fish and shellfish.
So the oysters are natural vacuum cleaners in a way of this nuisance?
They are. They remediate the nitrogen and they're turning the algae into protein, which is amazing.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Skip Bennett, the founder of Island Creek Oysters, a company that harvests oysters and sells them to more than 400 chefs in the United States. Restaurants that serve Island Creek oysters include Shaw's Crab House in Chicago, King's Seafood in Los Angeles, and the Oyster Bar in New York's Grand Central Station. You grew up in Duxbury, Massachusetts, and shell fishing is an important part of your life. Yet, when you graduated from college in 1989, you had a finance degree and you thought you'd work on Wall Street. How come?
You know, it was the 80s, and I loved finance when I was in school, and I had a lot of friends that were in New York. I told everybody I was just going to work on the Bay for one more summer and try to save enough money to buy a suit and get my resume together. And I'm still working on it. So.
How did that not happen?
Well, so in 1989, I was digging mussels in Duxbury. And I loved working outside. I loved the independence of working on the Bay, the physical work. It just suited me. I heard about some guys out on the Cape, way out in Wellfleet, that were growing clams. I thought that sounded kind of interesting. As fishermen, they were barely making grocery money, and that now that they were growing clams, they were all driving around in new trucks and going to Florida for the winter. I thought, what else do I need?
So you discovered these clam producers, and you started then a clam business.
I did. I started a clam farm, and the town of Duxbury was generous enough to license me 3 acres of kind of non-productive areas in the bay. So I got 3 acres and started growing clams. I didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. I couldn't borrow money. I couldn't imagine going to a bank and telling them I was going to borrow money to put clam seed in the bay.
Did you try?
No, I don't think so.
And who was this? This was yourself and who
it was,
else?
It was really me back in those days, and I was shellfishing, and that was where I got the money to buy the clam seed. So it was really hard-earned money, you know, bent over in the mud digging clams to save enough money to buy the clam seed. So that went along pretty well, and each year I started harvesting in 93, so I really rolled that money back into the clam farm. And in 95, I got wiped out by a protozoan parasite. It's specific to clams. It was tough. I really needed to at least try another option.
And this is while your buddies are working in New York in suits on Wall Street.
Yeah, which was probably, you know, in retrospect, being in debt was really hard. And it was really the uncertainty of what I was doing with my life that was the most difficult. At some level, it felt incredibly irresponsible.
Just day to day, even though it was challenging, were you just like existentially feeling fulfilled, or were you more stressed out about the income issue?
Well, I was stressed out about the income, but I had no doubt that's what I was supposed to be doing with my life.
What about your parents? What were they doing?
Well, my dad was a lobsterman, and I think they thought I was crazy.
And your dad also owned a gas station.
He did, yep. Mm-hmm. And I grew up working there as mm-hmm. a kid.
So you thought, all right, I'll try oysters on.
Yep.
And there was this farm you discovered in Maine called, appropriately, the Chancealong Farm.
Yeah.
How did you come into contact with them?
They had a nursery at Chancealong Farm, which was owned by the Horn family. So they were growing seed up there.
By seed, you mean?
We refer to, you know, baby shellfish as seed. You know, like a half an inch. They were already metamorphous baby oysters that they had grown all summer long. They were really, really pioneers in figuring out how to grow seed, which really kind of made a match made in heaven where, you know, I bought seed from them, brought it back, and I had pretty good success on the grow outside and kind of struck up a friendship with them. And in 97, their son Christian moved down to Duxbury. He and I really kind of pioneered the grow out part in Duxbury.
Now, you know, when you say you were the sole fisherman or the sole oyster farmer and now you had this partner, I think of like the old man in the sea alone on the ocean. But what was your social life like at the time?
I was working all the time, and it was really nice to suddenly have somebody that understood. For the most part, when I would talk about what I was doing on the water, people's eyes would glaze over and they really had no idea of what I was talking about. And at that point, I was newly married. I had a little baby, a 96 and 98. Yeah, so I had two. So I was busy.
What is your wife's name?
I'm divorced.
What was
Shannon.
And what did she make of what you were doing?
I think she thought I was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was challenging for both of us.
In 2001, you had a pivot moment that was coincident with September 11th happening. People were no longer wanted to buy, you know, luxury items, which oysters were considered part of. But why did that occurrence actually help your business, ironically?
Well, I had a college friend who was working in high tech. So he was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was talking with him and complaining about how desperate I was to sell oysters. And he told me about a restaurant in Cambridge called the East Coast Grill. He said that they had oysters on the menu. So I got in my old pickup truck and out of desperation drove up there and I met Chris Schlesinger, the owner of the East Coast Grill. And I didn't know if he'd laugh at me or if they'd kick me out of the restaurant, but he and Eric, his sous chef, they couldn't believe that, A, there was an oyster farmer in Massachusetts, and B, that he was standing in their restaurant. So basically he said, you know, we want to buy all of our oysters from you. On that kind of momentum, I came back and I had a book that somebody had given me. It was the history of oysters. And in the back of the book, there were these famous oyster bars all across the United States. So I was flipping through it and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And the first one I called was a place called Le Bernardin in Manhattan. And I asked to speak to the kitchen and they asked why. And I told them and they said, hang on. And I got this guy on the phone. His name was Eric. and I couldn't hardly understand him because mm-hmm. of his French accent. And we talked about oysters and oysters in France, and he told me what he wanted for the oysters, so I sent him a sample. He told me he wanted smaller, deeper cup oysters, so again, we kept kind of culling through and found the oysters that he wanted, and we started selling to Eric Repair at Le Bernardin.
Now,
so from there, it was, you know, the Old Everett Grill in Washington, D.C., Water Grill in L.A., Sansom Street Oyster Bar in Philadelphia. We just started hitting all these great old oyster bars. And
so it was ultimately you're getting in your truck and you're going yourself to connect with these chefs directly, such as Eric Repair at Le Bernardin. And Le Bernardin being one of the most prominent seafood restaurants in New York City and the East Coast Grill in Boston, that caused your situation to turn around.
Yeah, and it really, it was the beginning of kind of the model that we built. And in retrospect, it was the beginning of farm to table.
Right.
It was just that our farm was in the water.
How did relationships with, let's say, the French Laundry and Thomas Keller, per se, how did that originate?
Well, that's actually a pretty interesting one. The beginning was that when Thomas opened in New York, he opened per se, they had a fire in the kitchen. You know, they'd spent years building this restaurant, and it must have been devastating for them, you know, for him and also for the staff, but they regrouped after the fire, and Thomas said, I want something good to come out of this. Go out and find cool new products, he told the whole staff. And two chefs, Rory Herman and Chris Lahamidou, found us. After a few years of serving the per se, we reached out to French Laundry, and we were able to, you know, to get into French Laundry as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Skip Bennett, the founder of Island Creek Oysters. Just as Thomas Keller starts off with a fire in his restaurant, you started out with the bay freezing. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so every once in a while, the bay will freeze over completely. And it was an exceptionally cold winter. And the bay froze so solid that we were able to drive trucks out there. So at low tide, we were driving out on the ice and cutting through with chainsaws. The bay ice was about a foot thick. So we knew where the oysters were, and we could pull the oyster bags up through the ice. And it wasn't just per se. It was, you know, we had a whole bunch of restaurants that at that time we felt like we really couldn't let them down.
In addition to having these direct relationships with these chefs, you also sell your oysters online. Can you describe that a little more?
Yeah, we have this kind of new e-commerce platform that we're developing. We're really excited about it. Late last night, I went back to the hatchery, and I was kind of messing around with some stuff, and I decided to grade one of the silos of seed, and I dumped the seed out on the screen and started washing it through the screen to see how big they were, and I realized that the pile was about 2 million. They were on a 500 micron screen, which makes them like the size of a flake of pepper, barely visible. And so I've never done this before, but I started thinking about that there were 2 million oysters there, and where would these oysters end up? And it was kind of cool to think, you know, maybe they'll end up at somebody's dinner party in Aspen at Christmas time, or all the, you know, people's homes that they could end up in, and how those people would be excited to get those oysters.
How about the oyster pearls? How does the pearl originate?
So most of the pearls the commercial pearls are grown, I think they're freshwater oysters, so they're a different species. Our oysters will make pearls, but they're tiny. All shellfish make pearls, or can make pearls. And but all the ones that we found are like the size of a BB, so they're really small. But still kind of neat when you find one. You know, I've found probably two or three in my whole career as an oyster farmer, so I'd have to be pretty patient to be a pearl farmer.
Have you kept them?
I think, yeah, I have one, and I've given the other ones away.
You mentioned that you like the physical work of being out there, and I think, you know, my being in New York City, I've been thinking lately how we as human beings need physical work. That's what we did on the farms 100 years ago, and all of us here in New York are kind of simulating that physical work in gyms and on exercise bikes. Do you think about that kind of more holistically at all?
Unfortunately, I don't do as much physical work as I used to, but it is really, I think it's important for all of us to not only do physical work, but to be outside and to be in the sun and, just out in the elements. And I think it's really healthy. That's the way we've evolved to be physical and to be outdoors. I think it's pretty unnatural the way that we live now. I was reading something recently on social media that they said that 10,000 year ago, man would have kicked our butts. They were farmers and they would have to trek out to the fields every day. And the physical work that they did day in and day out would put our running on treadmills and lifting weights to shame.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jessica.
My guest has been Skip Bennett, founder of Island Creek Oysters. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.